Welcome to the Time We Have podcast, presented to you by Motor Neuron Disease, New South Wales. MND New South Wales acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land we live on. We pay our respects to all elders, past and present, of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations.
We will never forget the person, never forget the relationship that we had, but the way in which we remember ultimately will become less painful.
Hello and a very warm welcome to the MND New South Wales podcast, The Time We Have. My name is Sabine Krajewski and I'm the education team leader at Motor Neuron Disease New South Wales. Every few weeks, I'm speaking with someone who is in some way connected to motor neuron disease. And today, my guest is Mandy Cox. She's a grief counsellor with Good Grief, and she also works out of her private practice, Urban Sparrow. She has provided grief counselling since 2006, and she is connected to several projects at MND New South Wales. Welcome, Mandy.
Thanks, Sabine. It's great to be here.
As usual, I'm in my home office in Sydney with a nice cappuccino, and I need it to keep warm. Where are you at the moment?
I'm up on Awabakal land, Sabine. I'm in Newcastle in a little unit right by the beach. And yes, it's very chilly this morning, but it's quite warm where I am.
That's good for you. Just then for me and my cappuccino. Okay, when we spoke recently, you told me that you grew up in Melbourne, but then you went to live up in Katherine and Darwin from 1997 to 2009. And you loved it there. So I'm going to talk about, I'd like to talk about that a little bit, but start with your studies first. So your first degree was in ministry and you met your husband that way, I think, when you were studying. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, thanks, Sabine. Yes, I went to study back in the early 1990s. I started off doing a diploma that was to prepare me to work overseas. However, I did complete that diploma and then went on to study a Bachelor of Ministry. And it was at that time that I met my husband, James. And when we married, we took up a position in Katherine at the Katherine Baptist Church, where my husband was a minister there for 5 years. So that was our first taste of living up in the Northern Territory. While we were up there, when we went up there, we took up our three-month-old baby boy, Jess. And while I was there, we had two children, Esther and Annalise. And so a lot of my time was spent obviously looking after the children, but also working a lot with the women in the community and, you know, was involved in all sorts of things in relation to the broader community as well as the church. And it was a very rich time in lots of ways for both my husband and I, but obviously very busy having three small children as well.
Okay. And your husband, what did you say? He did also study ministry.
Yeah, he studied his Bachelor of Theology.
But in Darwin, in the Northern Territories, you worked as a spiritual care coordinator and palliative care. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so once we left Katherine, I actually went back down to Melbourne and completed my degree in ministry. And then we'd always intended to return to Darwin. We had a real love for the Northern Territory and probably still do in some ways. We moved up to the Northern Territory and we wanted to extend ourselves a lot more into the community and sort of meandered through and eventually started a market stall out of Mindle Beach Market where we were importing goods from grassroots communities in a number of countries and supporting them through their craft work and other work that they were doing. So that was something that we did a couple of times a week, which was very invigorating and exciting. And then along with that, I began working in palliative care. My role was to do a fill-in role for 6 weeks as the spiritual care coordinator. And so that was to really be able to support people who were going through the hospice, so both the people who were there for end-of-life care as well as their families, and also offering support to people who were supporting their loved ones in the community where they were also had a terminal illness and were supporting them with end-of-life care. And it was in that capacity, I guess, that I was first really confronted with being with people in the dying and the grieving space. And And I have to tell you that it was never something that I thought, oh, I hope I can work in this space. It was never something that I had even imagined. The thought had never crossed my mind. And in fact, I was a little reluctant to step into the space to begin with.
Okay. But
once I walked in and began working there, I realized that I had found a place that was incredibly rich and deep, as well as incredibly confronting and challenging at times as well.
It's almost an accidental thing that happened to you. So you happen to come across this job and then you realize that you have a lot to give in that capacity and it works well. And then you sort of stayed in that realm.
That's right. So absolutely. And I think, you know, some of the factors that led me to stay in that space were the way that the palliative care team were operating at that time and recognizing that I wasn't doing it on my own. It wasn't just something that I had to do, that there was a multidisciplinary team that we were all there together and we were working as a team. And that was incredibly supportive as well. And I guess once I was in that space, I realized that there's such a great need for people to be able to walk with those that are perhaps beginning one of the most difficult journeys that they're going to take in their lives, both for those that are dying, but also for those who are supporting them in that journey.
Okay. Did that work have an effect on you? Do you work in palliative care on an ongoing basis? I guess you need a bit of a balance in life. And if you have small children, that's probably that balance of life in there. But how did it have an effect on you?
Oh, absolutely. I think to say, first and foremost, it had a profound effect on me. It had a profound effect on the way I saw the world, on the way that I saw our lives. And it did cause a lot of very deep reflection and still does, to be really honest with you. I think it really has caused me to hold life far more gently and to be incredibly grateful for the life that we do have on a day-to-day basis. And I think the other side of that as well is, yes, absolutely, I did need to find balance. And I had spent a lot of my life doing one form of dancing or another. And when I was in Darwin, I took up belly dancing, actually. And it really provided the balance that I needed. And so, on the one side, I was really able to express myself through movement and really celebrate life. And that was very much balanced with, I guess, that day-to-day reality also of, you know, supporting and being with people who were in a very different space in their lives. So, yeah, the balance was very necessary and incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's a great skill level. Absolutely. That's right. But a lot more fun as well, you know.
And you need a belly, and I don't think you have one.
I've been nurturing that over many years.
Okay. I'll get back to that and how looking after people at the end of life changes you or what effect it has on you. But in 2010, you went to Canberra and you focused on grief and loss and trauma studies. So you got in even deeper. Do you think that to be professional about it changes or protects you also a bit from the effect if you have more theory around it?
Look, I think it certainly supports the work that you're doing. And also if that's a profession that you're going to be staying in, then, you know, I think there's real wisdom in being able to learn as much as you can about it as well. I think it also enables me, us, to be able to recognize grief in a more objective way as well. So whilst we're touched by the stories of others and deeply impacted at times by what we're listening to and what we're holding, it's also really important that we have what's required to be able to accompany and guide people through their grieving journey as well, so that we don't get stuck in another person's grief, that we have the tools and the capacity to be able to walk through with them. So absolutely, I think it's really imperative.
So you finished your master's in 2013 and you are a certified bereavement practitioner. You've worked in different organizations and you also established the Canberra Grief Centre with a colleague in 2013. What is a grief centre?
Well, my colleague Sonia Fenwick and I saw things very similarly and recognised that there was a real need to be able to offer people that support and guidance through grief. So I guess essentially, in terms of being a grief counsellor and a grief centre, the idea was that we would be able to offer one-on-one grief counselling support group work, as well as to be able to offer workshops and training for other professionals to be able to work with people in their own communities and their organisations around grief and loss. Yeah, it had that focus of being able to offer various aspects relating to grief, and I guess also to be able to increase that grief literature in our communities as well, because I think we understand that grief is one of those things that we still find incredibly difficult to be able to talk about, and we have very limited vocabulary, I think, around the grieving experience. And so to be able to have a focus on that and to be able to give people more confidence to be able to allow themselves to go through their grieving experience.
Okay, yeah. You'd moved to Newcastle with your whole family in 2019, and you also practiced from there as a counsellor and supervisor in your own private practice, and you called it Urban Sparrow. Does it have a meaning, Urban Sparrow?
Look, it has meaning for me, I guess, is what I'd say. At the time when I was when I knew that we were moving up to Newcastle, I wanted to be able to continue on in private practice. Mm-hmm. And I'd been reading a beautiful book at the time called Birds, Art, Life, Death by Keo McClear, a Canadian woman. And I was really taken by this work, the spotlight that she shone on the bird life and how it relates to the different seasons in our lives. And it was done with the backdrop of her own father dying. And so in many ways, it was her own expression of grief, her own journey of coming to terms with the deterioration of her father's health, which led to his eventual death. And the connection that she found in doing some bird watching and learning about the habits of birds and in terms of what that looks like throughout the seasons in a year. And I just found that it really struck me in terms of my own desire to be able to walk with people in their journey, whether it's through grief or other aspects of their lives, as well as my own journey of change and adaptation and growth and healing. And so I found there was such a resonance, and recognizing, you know, that the urban sparrow is such an overlooked bird, such an ordinary common bird, and yet it also has great beauty to it. We can find such delight in the most common,
everyday things. That's a beautiful connection. It's really worth pointing out. Let's talk a little bit more about grief. You told me that bereavement is a universal thing, so everyone will suffer loss at some point, but grief is unique. So can you explain what that actually means, then? How is grief unique?
Yes, so it's a great statement, and it's a statement that's taken by William Warden, who says bereavement is universal, grief is not. Mm-hmm. And I guess what it really speaks to is the fact that every human being will experience grief throughout their life.
Yes.
In that sense, it is universal. But the way in which we grieve will be absolutely unique. And Warden also speaks to what he calls mediating factors. These mediating factors in our lives that will actually shape the very unique expression of our grief. So, for example, some of the mediating factors that he talks about are, you know, the way in which a person has died, the nature of the attachment, the kind of relationship that we had with that person who has died or is dying, the type of death, our own personality, you know, the ways in which we cope, our gender, our age, and some of the social variables around our culture, our religious beliefs, community supports. All of these things are what we call the mediating factors, and they are what will absolutely shape the way in which we grieve.
Yeah.
And in a sense, we all grieve in a very unique and distinct way. And I think what it says about that is that whilst we might have some understanding of the grieving process, we can never really know how another person is truly grieving because of the mediating factors.
Yeah. There is a very famous grief model by Kubler-Ross, who wrote about it in her book Death and Dying in 1969. Mm. So she describes a grief model and five different stages of grief. And I know that the model is now seen as outdated. Why is that? What would you say about that model and why it's not applicable?
Kubler-Ross Her work began through her research, working with people who were dying rather than people who were grieving as such or mourning.
All right, yes.
Mm-hmm. So her research was built on a study that she did in hospice work. And so I guess it's important to be able to make that distinction right up front that the people in which she was researching were not essentially the mourners or the grievers. They were the ones that were dying. I think rather than Kubler-Ross's work being outdated, I think it's probably more true to say that there have been many contemporary theorists who have actually built on her work. I think one of the things that the contemporary theorists would say is that the stages of grief has probably been interpreted in a way where people feel that they need to go through, first of all, through those five stages. And I can't even remember them all, but things like, denial, anger, bargaining, acceptance, and so on. And I guess that's been interpreted in a way that perhaps is not even the way that Kubler-Ross intended it. But really what the contemporary theorists are saying is that, grief is not linear. It's not something that we go from one aspect to the next. We know that the grieving experience is anything but linear. It's tumultuous. It can be described as being like a roller coaster or like waves. It's unpredictable. It's extreme. It's all of those things. And so whilst we might experience some of those stages that Kubler-Ross talks about, there might be anger, there might be denial, there might be these aspects of it. I think what the more contemporary theorists is allowing for is a much broader expression of this coming and going, of this re-entering, of being triggered and falling back into. The distinctive of the contemporary theorists, and particularly for Warden, really what he's talking about is that when we grieve, what becomes important is that we recognize the movement within our grief, that we're moving from being in one place to another. And it's this movement that really allows for the adjustments, the changes, so essentially the adaptations that we have to make, but also the growth and the healing that comes as we allow ourselves to enter into the grieving space.
Yeah.
But it is a model. So models are theoretical frameworks, right? So, and they, of course, also change over time. And Kubler-Ross probably did not mean that everything has to be static and go exactly according to plan and one phase follows the next in that order, right?
But isn't someone who's dying also grieving?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point you made. And absolutely they are. However, their experience of grief will be different to those who are left behind, the ones who are grieving. Again, it will be very unique because this is really happening to them. They're facing their mortality. They're facing their end of life. So, again, it'll be unique and it will be different for them as well. Yeah. But I think your point is right that any model only ever serves as a framework.
And does grief ever go away?
It's a great question. And I guess I think what we would say, rather than grief going away, it's about really being able to complete that initial mourning, the mourning phase of going through the initial parts of being able to accept the reality of the loss and allowing ourselves to grieve the pain of the loss, finding those adjustments in life, and then being able to find the enduring connection with the person that's been lost as we continue to make those adjustments and move forward. But even in doing that, of course, there'll be times when our grief is triggered.
Yeah.
But I guess what we're looking for really, so does it ever disappear? I don't think we will never forget the person. Yeah. We'll never forget the relationship that we had. But the way in which we remember ultimately will become less painful. Less intense, and will enable us to be able to live a full life in the midst of also finding that enduring connection with that person. So our grief changes and enables us to be able to live fully and to be able to live with hope again. I think that's how I describe it.
A friend of mine told me that when her mother died, what consoled her was another friend telling her, grief will subside, it will go away, but the place in your heart where your mother was, there will always be a hole. And she found that very consoling. And actually, when I heard it, I thought about it and I thought, I don't know if that would console, or if I find that consoling, because it means that at a certain time, your heart is full of holes. And how do you live with a holy heart? You know, it's, you know what I mean? I like images, but somehow I found it a bit disturbing as well.
Yes, yes. And look, I think there's a thousand ways to describe it, Sabine. And and I guess that's also where our grief is a very personal expression. Mm. And I think ultimately we are looking for ways to be able to make sense of the very deep and painful experience that grief can often bring. And it will be many things for many different people. And I guess that's the part of how we find our way through, of how we make meaning around the losses that we experience. And that will be that's the unique component of our grief experience, I think. Yeah.
There are also different types of grief. So in M&D, there's a lot of talk about anticipatory grief. Can you talk to different types and what they mean, and particularly in palliative care maybe?
I think in relation to M&D, anticipatory grief is probably one of the aspects that people are very curious about and want to know more about.
Yeah.
And I think absolutely people do experience anticipatory grief. And essentially, you know, what we're talking about is recognizing that there's an impending loss, that there will be a loss and change coming their way. And whether that's in the next week or two or the next month or the next years, and for different types of diseases, you know, it will vary in relation to that. I think the important part is to recognise that for many people, they will begin to grieve at that point of diagnosis. You know, whatever the diagnosis is, whether it's cancer or M&D or whatever that is, already there's a loss. There's a loss of the hope. Of what we hoped we might have in terms of that. And then around that, there will be dozens, there'll be many, many other loss that we'll begin to recognise and see are going to be part of the journey over these months and years. And so it's normal and it's natural that people begin to grieve at that point. I guess one of the questions that people often ask then is, if I'm doing all this grieving now, when the person dies, does that mean that my grief is already done? You know, have I done it? And I think, you know, again, the research is out on this, but essentially for some people, it may be that their grief, you know, that they've been able to work with their grief and they've been able to journey along that road to a point where their grief is a lot less intense after the loss. But for others, that's not the case.
Okay. So I don't think you have a unique individual. Yeah.
And for some people, and I've known some people who are carers, and as your listeners know, that the caring role is pretty intense at times.
Yeah.
It's pretty full on. And for some people, their mindset will be grief can wait. Grief will come when I'm no longer with this person. And I completely understand that they don't want to be mourning the loss while they still have the person in front of them. They want to be able to do everything that they can while they're here, and their grieving will wait. But for others, that's not possible. So, again, I think we've got this very unique response around what their needs are. And often for carers, you know, we know that carers are very reluctant to look after themselves and to listen to their needs while they're caring for someone else, which, again, is very understandable. And so for many people, they put their grief on hold until that has died. So there's many ways in which we can look at it and work with it. I guess another type of grief that is often talked about is perhaps a more disenfranchised grief. And that's a grief where the griever feels that they don't really have permission, that perhaps society doesn't recognise the loss, and so therefore the person doesn't feel that they have permission to grieve. So it can be a very isolating and lonely loss that is done in the privacy of their own home. And there can be lots of reasons why a person feels that their grief is not recognised, or that they don't feel that they have permission to grieve. And that can come through a lot of losses.
Can you give an example?
I think, you know, in my experience over the years, I guess one of the places where I saw this happening a lot was where parents may have had to have a termination of pregnancy. And so for them, there could be a lot of issues around feeling that, well, you know, they made that choice, so they don't have a right to grieve.
Right. Which,
you know, really a very faulty narrative, and not one that I'd encourage at all.
No.
But I think
the judgment,
that self-judgment, yeah. You know, or the judgment of society, or the judgment of certain groups, you know, within society that might say, oh, well, you know, this is not the right way to go, but they don't know the story, they don't know the people, they don't know the family.
Yeah.
And so what that can do is it can bury the grief. It can cause a person not to want to express that publicly or socially.
Is that where there are choices involved? So, for example, if you separate, I mean, the grief is not only about death, right? So it could be other things, you know, anything, and that sometimes also is not acceptable to society. What comes to mind there is the way communities deal with grief has changed altogether. Some of the signifiers that we used to have are just not there anymore. So people used to, if they lost their partner, go in black for a whole year or something like that, which is also a protection for the person who's grieving, right? So if you don't have those signifiers anymore, all we have now is if you lose a close relative, you get a day off work or you can change your flight for free, but there's nothing really to protect that person or to signify to other people that they should be more careful because it's a vulnerable time for them. So how did that happen that we lost all of those markers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know for sure how that happened, but you're right, Sabine, that I think what this really speaks to essentially is permission giving. You know, what it says, you know, for example, you know, when I grew up in Melbourne, I used to dance over in Preston and it was a very large Italian community over there. And there'd be lots of older women who'd be walking around dressed in black. And so we knew that they were widows. You know, we knew that from the outset. Yeah. And what that does essentially is that it gives them permission to be able to grieve. To perhaps not have to embark in some of the expectations in society, like attending communities or different gatherings, that it gives everyone the knowledge that they may not be feeling like they want to engage fully just yet.
Exactly.
And over the years, I think, you know, part of that happened through our religious institutions where protocols perhaps changed or loosened, but also more broadly in society as well, where we're given more freedoms, more choices, and the way in which we express ourselves have broadened. But you're right that in the mix of all of that, somehow some of these mourning rituals have been lost.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of the day, what we're really wanting to see restored is perhaps not so much that people need to go around in black or purple as they
did
in Victoria's time, but more so for us as a community to be able to recognise and acknowledge the enormity of the grief that people might be going through. And I think that's where we've still got a lot of work.
Right, to pay more attention to it. On the other side, I thought it could also be a positive sign that, for example, if you go to a funeral, people won't necessarily wear black anymore. Mm. Even the look of coffins have changed. Some people paint on the coffins and so on. So is that sort of a step in the direction of making it more part of life and as a natural, normal thing?
Yeah, I think they certainly are some positive steps that we're shifting the funeral rituals, you know, out of that very kind of closed space, you know, thinking about even children attending funerals. You know, I wasn't allowed to attend my grandmother's funeral when I was a child. Mm. And whereas these days we do see that children are encouraged to attend, to perhaps even, you know, when I worked in palliative care, I remember a family where they got the grandchildren to paint onto the coffin, you know, to write letters to put into the coffin, you know, all those sorts of things. So I think they are certainly steps in the right direction. I think it is about being able to bring death and grief back into the community sphere, as much as we can, not losing the respect or the enormity of it, but being able to find a place for it back in our community. Absolutely. Mm.
Yeah. So when we go back to grief and the feeling of grief and loss, what is a normal grieving and when should people seek support? When is it time to call Mandy?
That's a great question. And a very broad question. You're right. I think the starting point, no, it's a great question. I think the starting point is always recognizing that grief is a normal response to loss. And to be able to keep it in that frame for as long as we possibly can. I was going to read a quote. I think I've got it here by Julian Barnes. Yeah, Julian Barnes, an English literary author.
Yeah.
He lost his wife of many years and he wrote a beautiful reflection in his book, Levels of Life. And he writes that grief is a human, not a medical condition. And while there are pills to help us forget it and everything else, there are no pills to cure it. And so I think being able to recognize that grief is both a normal and a necessary process when we experience loss and change. Mm. And so for most people, Sabine, they don't need someone like Mandy. Most people will actually find a way to navigate their grief journey. Mm. Really, I think the point at where people are looking or needing more support is essentially where their grief might get stuck or derailed. We talk about complicated grief. So a grief is somehow halted or stuck for many reasons. There can be so many reasons why a person is not able to continue on in that normal and natural way. And I think when that happens, that's a time when people might benefit from being able to reach out and access a grief counsellor or even a support group that might also be helpful for them.
So what does a grief counsellor do then?
I think a grief counsellor does many things. A grief counsellor can validate their grief, recognise that perhaps whilst their grief might feel out of control and overwhelming, that for some of those people, they're tracking as well as they could be tracking, and that it's actually about being able to stay the course and continue to grieve the way they're grieving. Yeah. A grief counsellor can also recognise where their grief is getting stuck, where the grief is more complicated, or where there are also many other complexities that are sitting around that grief, where there might be traumatic elements that sit around grief or other factors that are entwined in and amongst the grief that are strangling or preventing the grief from being able to continue its journey. And so at that point, the grief counsellor may have capacity to be able to work with some of the elements where that person is getting stuck. An example of that might be if there's a coronial inquest and that becomes protracted, and there might be a lot of things that are sitting around the outcome of that coronial inquest. And if it doesn't land where the family are hoping it will land, it can cause lots of other things to come in and prevent them from being able to focus on the grief. And their focus is then shifted onto other elements that sit around the grief but are actually preventing that person from doing the grief they need to do. And so essentially the role of the grief counsellor can be to help a person to attend to some of those other aspects that might be sitting around the loss and also very gently enable them to get back on track, to get back on that part of the grief journey, and to then enable them to do the grieving that they need to do.
Yeah, that sounds very useful though. Is it possible that grief also triggers depression, that people fall in depression because they can't deal with it, or is that a different, completely different thing?
Yeah, I think there's an interesting relationship between grief and depression. Mm-hmm. We need to be careful to be able to recognise which is what.
Yeah.
And often people...
The one can mask the other.
Yes. Yeah. And well, particularly grief, sadness can be misdiagnosed as depression.
Mm. Yeah. Yep.
So that's usually the way it goes. If there's going to be, if one masks the other, often it is that we're too quick to misdiagnose grief and depression, because we are often very uncomfortable around deep sadness. And I think the other thing I'd say is that if we are not able to attend to the deep sadness, to the grief response, that if that doesn't have a place to be expressed, it will often be repressed. And if we're not careful, over, you know, the period of many months or years, that can turn into depression. So it has a very interesting that we need to be aware of.
So you also mentioned support groups, which is a little bit different. And I have actually been to one that you offered at one of our retreats for carers. So I call it group counseling, but that's not quite correct. So can you talk to what that actually is and what happens in such a group session?
Yeah, there is many support groups around our country that organisations will offer from time to time. And I think essentially a support group gives people an opportunity to come together where there might be a loss of a similar nature. So obviously, for example, MND. I think the real benefits of being a part of a support group are that it helps us to see that we're not alone. It moves us out of perhaps a very isolated grief. It helps us to recognise and maybe see aspects of our own grief journey in the story of other people. And for some people, that can be really encouraging and helpful. I need to point out that support groups are not for everyone. For some people, the last thing they want or need is to sit in a group where it's reinforcing the deep level of sadness or pain that they might be experiencing. And so support groups are not for everyone. But I think support groups, they both can help people who are part of them to both receive and to give. You know, it's very much a mutual undertaking of being able to both share their stories and to give into that space, but also to receive as well, to be receiving the support and care of others. So often they're peer-led groups, usually with a facilitator, a trained facilitator,
who
gently guide and ensure that the group remains helpful and supportive. You know, so we don't want, you know, one person dominating or taking over or, you know, those sorts of things. But
that's a facilitating part.
I think it can really provide something that could be helpful for people as they journey.
I was curious at the time because I thought a support group is something you have to go several times to get something out of it. And this was sort of a one-off for the people there. And it was really amazing to see that even a one-off can be very useful for the people attending.
That's right. And I think that can take on lots of different shapes. I've often run groups that will meet monthly. You know, that's a common kind of a format where they might meet monthly. And there might be a little bit of input by a facilitator as well around, you know, various aspects of grief. So there might be a little bit of education that sits there. But I think the bulk of it is really around being able to support one another, hear and share the stories as well.
So if I think about the families who have someone living with motor neuron disease that we support at MND New South Wales, there are very often children in those families. So they're either the children of the person or the grandchildren of the person with MND. So do children grieve differently? And how do adults who are going through grief themselves, are they able to take care of the children's grief as well? Or are there things they can do to help them?
Yeah, I think, you know, we go back to the core where we would say that, you know, bereavement is universal. And so that absolutely includes children as well. So there are some similarities. But I think one of the biggest factors that changes the nature of grieving for children is recognizing the developmental kind of space or the developmental level of a child. And not to put children in a box that says if they're this age, then they do this. Not at all like that.
But
to be able to recognise that for, you know, for example, very little children, their understanding of life is very concrete. And so the abstract is a very difficult notion for them to grasp. And so death in itself is shrouded in mystery, even for the wisest person, the wise adult. And so for a young child to be able to understand the notion of a parent not coming back anymore, no longer breathing, these are very complex notions for children to grasp. And so I think it's at that level that, you know, for the parents or the caregivers to be able to recognize what are some of the more helpful ways of being able to describe the death to a young child or to a child of a different age. You know, so if there are many children in the one family of different ages, their understanding and their grasp of death is going to vary and differ. I think the other thing to recognise that with children, some of the things that are known through the research around studying children who grieve is recognising that children will often grieve in bursts. And so one minute they might be overwhelmed in sorrow and sadness, and then 5 minutes later they're back out playing with friends or in the learning environment, often wanting to go to school. For children, routine can be really important. It can provide a real scaffolding and framework in which to hold their grief, in which to support. So giving them a sense of familiarity, of routine and control, and go on to actually support the grief that they're experiencing. Often children are known to express their grief through actions rather than words. So recognizing behavior will often change, and behavior will often be the thing that helps us to understand that there is grief going on, and that through the actions we might want to talk gently to children about noticing their change behavior and, you know, did they want to talk about what was going on at that point. And I think finally recognizing that children, especially young children, are dependent on the adults around them. Children can often feel really powerless around a death in the family.
Sure.
Some of the research really speaks to the isolation that they feel when parents are talking in and around them, but not to them about them. And so for parents, or for the surviving parent in a family where a person may have died, it's really important that they can find ways of being able to include children in the discussions.
Yeah.
Of course, they'll be appropriate to their age and development, but often we have this view that we don't talk about it in front of the children because we want to protect them. And feedback that we often get from children is that they feel excluded, and that makes them feel even more powerless at a time when they're feeling very out of control. So I think that parents who are trying to support their children through a loss, you know, I would encourage them, one, to trust their instincts and their intuition that they are able to be there for their children, and to continue to find ways of being able to engage them and to work with them and to include where that's appropriate.
And if people feel like they cannot be there for their children because they're barely coping, would that be also one of those situations where maybe a young person would call?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be able to reach out to various groups and organisations, even to their school, you know, where there are, you know, through my role at Good Grief, recognising that there are many programs on grief and loss, the Seasons program that takes children through working with change and loss. There are many schools in our country who run that program at the moment. So absolutely being able to inform the school, to inform the groups where the children might be, you know, having dance lessons or soccer or, you know, whatever activities they're involved in, so that the community can also be included in supporting the children at this very difficult time.
That just reminds me that we should maybe put some of those links up onto our Youth Hub website for young people to go to. I said in the beginning that I would come back to how working palliative care affected you, but also maybe the grief counselling. So how do you deal with your own grief? And do you feel that the grief counselling that you do and being around grieving people affects your everyday life and your emotional life?
Yeah, to the second part of the question, absolutely. You know, I'm a human. I'm no different to anyone that walks into the office, and we share that human experience. And there are some days when the stories of people touches me at an incredibly deep level, and you take those stories with you forever.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely true for me. And my own grief, I certainly, like everyone, have experienced my share of loss and change, both through death but also through other losses in my life. And I do pause to reflect. I also am in counselling and in supervision, and there are times when I need to work on my own grief, and I do that in a way that's appropriate for me. I'm a very private person at times, and so my grief is something that can often sit very deeply within me. And in the safety of trusted people, I will share and express it, and will also do a lot of that on my own as well. I do that out in nature. I love to get out and walk and be with nature, and I find that's incredibly healing for me. And I also do it in the privacy of my own rooms as well.
So it's the urban sparrow again. You go out and look at the sparrows.
I do indeed. Nature and love it, and it speaks to me, and I actually find it one of the most healing elements in my life, to be able to connect nature. I'm very fortunate that I live near the beach and can get out to the beach and walk amongst the trees and look at the water and hear the ocean, and I find it incredibly healing.
Me too, actually. The ocean has that effect on many people.
Absolutely, yeah.
Lydia, I ask all people on this podcast in the end what they find most important to spend their time on. So what is most important to you at this point in time?
For me, our relationships, friendships, my family, they are really everything to me. They're incredibly important. And I guess I do that in tandem with being able to immerse myself in nature as well. And I guess finding examples in nature that show me regeneration and healing. They're the things that inspire me and enable me to, I guess, sit back in the chair and sit and be with people. But they also sustain me, you know, as I navigate and negotiate all those really important relationships that I'm committed to in my life.
Great. Mandy, thank you so much for spending time with me. Our listeners this morning, it was a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much, Sabine.
MND New South Wales is funded largely by the generosity of community members, with only around 10 to 15% being received from government funding. If you'd like to donate, please go to www.mndnsw.org.au/donate or give MND New South Wales a call and one of our friendly staff will assist you. Check out our website for more information at www.mndnsw.org.au or call the MND New South Wales info line on 1800 777 175.